The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8888. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 25, 2023. As usual, it's bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block lettering in white, superimposed upon an image in the background of a young woman, blonde, wearing a sparkly green dress. She is Kelsey Ballerini, one of Time's 99 more of the world's rising stars, which equals 100, apparently. Perhaps there will be time to share some of those profiles. Also, in the upper right-hand corner is the thumbprint area that says our 100th year, referring to Time Magazine. The first thing I will read to you is actually a captioned photo. It's a double-page spread. Well, in the foreground, lots of vehicles. Goodness, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 side-by-side lanes, all going in the same direction. Mostly campers and recreational vehicles, lots of vans and minivans, a few sedans, and they're all lined up. I don't know if they're in movement or not, but they're all lined up to leave what looks like a parched, sandy beach. But it's very, very wide, wider than any of the beaches seen here in North Carolina, I think. And in the background are the mountains. Again, these look somewhat grayish, tannish, but there are clouds hovering above them with some blue sky permeating. Also, one of these peaks may be somewhat snow-covered, or it may just be really hard white granite. Desert desertion is the caption. Tens of thousands of Burning Man attendees begin their exodus from the Nevada desert September 4. After days of relentless downpours, stranded campers in impassable mud with limited water, food, and fuel. After a summer of extreme weather, experts noted the flooding at the Black Rock City festival site may be a harbinger of how climate change will continue to affect major outdoor events. This photograph is by Matt Mills McKnight of Reuters. Next is the View Inbox, the DC Brief by Philip Elliott. There's a photo here, not very large, but in color, it shows three individuals from left to right, Pence, DeSantis, and Ramaswamy from left, except there's a problem with this caption because Pence is not shown, and on the opposite side of Ramaswamy is a woman, and that may be Haley something or something Haley, Nikki Haley. Anyway, there are three people standing behind podiums. In Ramaswamy, in the center, is apparently speaking because he has his right arm raised and he's pointing toward something. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott is the Washington correspondent. To hear his rivals tell it, he's a charlatan, unfit for the job. But if you listen closely enough, you also hear fear about the prospects of Vivek Ramaswamy, a 38-year-old tech bro who was the surprising bullseye of August 23's first Republican presidential debate. Maybe it was Ramaswamy's consistent and confounding defense of all things Trump. Maybe it was his smooth talk and culture war acumen. Maybe it was just the fact that Ramaswamy frankly does not care how things were done before and just might have enough self-made money to go the distance. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie snarled that he had had enough already tonight of a guy who sounds like ChatGPT. Sniped former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, "You have no foreign policy experience, and it shows." And former Vice President Mike Pence mocked the rookie as someone in need of on-the-job training. Still, with ex-President Donald Trump skipping the debate and Ramaswamy doubling as his stand-in, his rivals needed to pile on. The GOP race is still Trump's to lose. He is polling at least 30 points ahead of his closest rival, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. But DeSantis has slogged through one of the worst stretches any White House hopeful has seen in recent memory. And Ramaswamy's betting he can slide into that lane without too heavy a lift. And his assessment is not entirely delusional. The fact that Ramaswamy merited any Oppo prep says a lot about the field. In normal times, he would not be a factor, an interloper with zero experience who should not matter. But the reboot of politics in the past 20 years makes this possible. And Ramaswamy beams politics. Next, another short article. This is by Alice Park, senior health correspondent, Health Matters. Every fall and winter, as temperatures drop, it is a battle between man and microbe, as viruses take advantage of our nesting instincts to spread. Sore throats, runny and stuffy noses, fevers, and coughs that won't stop. This respiratory disease season, however, we are armed for the first time with tools against respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, which causes disease primarily in older people and infants. That means more shots for these groups, but also, hopefully, fewer infections, visits to the hospital, even deaths from RSV. Here's advice from some experts on how to navigate the new choices and who should be getting which vaccines against the major respiratory diseases we will face in coming months. Flu. Everyone 6 months or older should be getting a flu shot to protect against influenza, says the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. COVID-19. There will be an updated vaccine, which health officials are likely to recommend for most people around mid-September. The vaccine will target the XBB.1.5 variant, which was circulating earlier this summer when the U.S. Food and Drug Administration's Expert Committee of Vaccine Experts met to advise manufacturers about updating their shots. While XBB.1.5 is no longer the dominant variant causing disease in the country, vaccine makers say they have conducted studies to show their XBB.1.5 shots continue to protect against some of the latest variants causing infections. RSV. There are two new vaccines for people over age 60 and those who are pregnant, and an antibody shot for babies under 8 months old to protect against RSV. CDC officials have already said people over 60 may get the vaccine, and babies under 8 months old who are born during months when RSV spreads from October to April should get the antibody injection. Older infants up to 19 months could also get the shot if they are at higher risk of infection. But health authorities are still discussing whether all pregnant people should be vaccinated, which would protect newborns from the moment they're born. Turning the page now to the View essay under the caption, World. What Prigozhin's End Says About Russia. This is by Simon Sebag Montefiore. Montefiore is author of The World, A Family History of Humanity, and Stalin, Court of the Red Tsar. There's also a small photo here in color. It's a portrait of Yevgeny Prigozhin at his grave site in St. Petersburg, August 30. He is in this portrait bald, wearing military attire with medals on his jacket. It's just a head and shoulder shot. But the portrait of him, which looks like a photograph, is in a gilded frame and surrounded by red and white roses. When a jet carrying Yevgeny Prigozhin, excuse me, that's spelled Prigozhin, the billionaire oligarch, catering tycoon, mercenary chieftain, and recent mutineer, crashed in August. The only surprise was that the interval between his June mutiny and his death was so long. But the predictability of Baroque violence in Russian court politics does not make it less shocking when it actually happens. We know very little about what goes on within the tiny inner circle of President Vladimir Putin. That's Russian president. A Kremlin spokesperson has admitted the crash could have been the result of deliberate wrongdoing, and it is clear that so far even supposed security experts are just reading the same telegram accounts as the rest of us. But the rise and fall of Prigozhin reveals many threads that run throughout Russian history and remain relevant now. It also chronicles the depletion of autocratic prestige, state power, and competent management, and thus raises the threat of the disintegration of Russia itself. First, all of this is a symptom of one-man rule, the habitual system in Russia throughout its long history. Prigozhin was the latest in a long line of court favorites, whose ascendancies are the inevitable result of personal power. Some imperial favorites were amazingly talented. Catherine the Great's co-ruler, Prince Potemkin, was the greatest statesman of the Romanov dynasty, and some not. Nicholas II's Rasputin was the most talentless. When these favorites lose the protection of their patrons, their falls are vertiginous. Prigozhin, one of Putin's St. Petersburg circle, received massive financial prizes, catering and later military contracts worth billions. He was one of the more competent managers whom Putin trusted. By helping to create the Wagner mercenary group, he allowed Russia to run an aggressive but deniable foreign policy. When Putin launched his wars against Ukraine and the military turned out to be ill-led and ill-supplied, Prigozhin's stormtroopers distinguished themselves with their resilience and atrocities. But sometime in the meat grinder of Bakhmut, the desperate fray turned his head. Prigozhin started to identify himself and his Wagner troops as blood-spattered heroes of Russia's war against Ukraine, and anyone who held them back as traitors, maybe even the president himself. It is a sign of Russia's weakening state that Putin allowed non-state players to command their own armies in the first place. And it turned out he could not prevent the Kremlin exploding into open rebellion June 23, when Prigozhin led his forces to advance on Moscow. Russian rulers are accustomed to facing rebellions and crushing them, but they have generally done so with more elan and more vivid violence. Peter the Great rushed back from his great embassy to Europe to torture thousands of rebel musketeers in specially constructed torture chambers. Catherine the Great unleashed her generals to crush the Pugachev rebellion. They sailed floating gallows down the Volga. Nicholas I, facing the mutiny of elite regiments in the streets of Petersburg, bombarded them with artillery. We may never know the real deal brokered by Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko to stop Prigozhin's advance, but Putin, ashen and lacking his trademark swagger, was forced to go on TV to denounce the treason. Every autocrat identifies totally with the state. Putin does not need to choose between national and personal betrayal, but treason is even more bitter if the traitor is a friend and protege. Peter the Great's own son plotted against him and then defected, escaping to Vienna in 1716. Peter lured him back, promising security, and then tortured him to death. Peter is Putin's hero. Photographs of the president's sumptuous yacht have revealed he displays there a statuette of the first emperor of Russia. No matter how close the traitor has to die. The rebellion of June 23 crossed every line. It was a humiliation for the president, not just a personal betrayal, also a political one, exposing to the world the incompetence and corruption of Putin's conduct of the war. Putin spoke of Prigozhin with almost paternal sadness, like a son he had to sacrifice. "I've known Prigozhin from the beginning of the 1990s, he said, with a strange wistfulness. "He was a man with a complex fate." It is said that the FSB Security Service urged Putin to let it liquidate Prigozhin at once. Putin was more cautious. There were loose ends to tie up. But also there was something else. He was teasing the loudmouthed Prigozhin, letting him feel safe and preen on his online channels. Even flaunt he was still alive, still in business. Stalin did the same with his enemies, like Nikolai Bukharin. In Russia, the mystique of power, from Peter the Great to Stalin's NKVD commissar, Lavrenty Beria, and on to Putin, is often won by the capricious deployment of violence. Now, Putin's mastery has to some extent been restored. Prigozhin's death was not just a bullet in the head, but a spectacular crash. Yet turbulence in the inner circle, the rise of warlords, the open feuding, the rebellion, all of this presages the deterioration of the Russian state. Here, the president and officials of a huge empire and powerful nuclear-armed intergalactic modern state conspired to liquidate one of their own intimates, behaving like narco-trafficantes or the cutthroats of a small town in Renaissance Italy. Yet so far, Russia's grandees and people are rallying to the motherland and its ruler. Its huge army is holding. Putin is damaged. Yet a weakened tyrant can rule for a long time, and war grinds on. From The Nation, she just had a baby. Soon, she'll start seventh grade. In post-Dobbs America, some girls can go out of state to get an abortion. This is the story of one who could not, by Charlotte Alter, Clarksdale, Mississippi. There's a photo here. Again, it's a double spread, two pages in color. Photographs by Lucy Garrett for Time. The caption reads, "Ashley in Clarksdale, Mississippi, August 1. Now, Ashley is apparently the shadow that's front and center, literally, of the photographer's lens, but it's blurred. So I am seeing and describing to you the blurry outline of an individual. I don't know if Ashley is facing the camera or has turned away from it. But the edges around Ashley are not blurred. In their buildings in the town of Clarksdale, Mississippi, there's a group of white crepe myrtle blooming on the right on a grassy lawn. And in the background, there's a tall green-leafed tree. Off to the left, there's a pretty well-cared-for brick building with a large loading dock on the side and floor-to-ceiling windows toward the front. Then in the back, that is directly in the near foreground, there are more dilapidated-looking buildings. Brick and the whitewash is washing off the brick, and the windows are boarded up. It says something about club. And then another building, which looks like it might be metal, sheet metal, like tin roofs, only the siding is of that fabric. It says Delta Wholesale on it. And those windows are also boarded up. So now, turning the page to find out more about Ashley in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And this was written, again, by Charlotte Alter, with reporting by Leslie Dickstein. Ashley just had a baby. She's sitting on the couch in a relative's apartment in Clarksdale, Mississippi, wearing camel print leggings and fiddling with the plastic hospital bracelet still on her wrists. It is August and pushing 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which means the brown patterned curtains are drawn, the air conditioner's on high, and the room feels like a hiding place. Peanut, the baby boy she delivered 2 days earlier, is asleep in a car seat at her feet, dressed in a little blue outfit. Ashley's surrounded by family, but nobody's smiling. One relative silently eats lunch in the kitchen. Her two siblings stare glumly at their phones, and her mother, Regina, watches from across the room. Ashley was discharged from the hospital only hours ago. But there are no baby presents or toys in the room, no visible diapers or ointments or bottles. Almost nobody knows Peanut exists because almost nobody knew Ashley was pregnant. She's 13 years old and soon she'll start 7th grade. In the fall of 2022, Ashley was raped by a stranger in the yard outside her home, her mother says. For weeks, she did not tell anybody what had happened, not even her mom, but Regina knew something was wrong. Ashley used to love going outside to make dances for her TikTok, but suddenly she refused to leave her bedroom. When she turned 13 that November, she was not in the mood to celebrate. She just said, "It hurts." Regina remembers. She was crying in her room. I asked her what was wrong, and she said she didn't want to tell me. To protect the privacy of a juvenile rape survivor, Time is using pseudonyms to refer to Ashley and Regina. Peanut is the baby's nickname. The signs were obvious only in retrospect. Ashley started feeling sick to her stomach. Regina thought it was related to her diet. At one point, Regina even asked Ashley if she was pregnant, and Ashley said nothing. Regina had not yet explained to her daughter how a baby's made, because she did not think Ashley was old enough to understand. They need to be kids, Regina says. She does not think Ashley even realized that what happened to her could lead to a pregnancy. January 11, Ashley began throwing up so much, Regina took her to the emergency room at Northwest Regional Medical Center. When her blood work came back, the hospital called the police. One nurse came in and asked Ashley, "What have you been doing?" Regina recalls. That's when they found out Ashley was pregnant. "I broke down," Regina says. Dr. Eric Balthrop was the OBGYN on call that day. Excuse me, that's Erica, E-R-I-C-A. Balthrop is an assured, muscular woman with close-cropped cornrows and a tattoo of a feather running down her arm. She ordered an ultrasound and determined Ashley was 10 or 11 weeks along. It was surreal for her, Balthrop recalls. She just had no clue. The doctor could not get Ashley to answer questions or to speak at all. She would not open her mouth. Balthrop spoke about her patient's medical history with Regina's permission. At their second visit, about a week later, Regina tentatively asked Balthrop if there was any way to terminate Ashley's pregnancy. 7 months earlier, Balthrop could have directed Ashley to abortion clinics in Memphis, 90 minutes north, or in Jackson, Mississippi, 2.5 hours south. But today, Ashley lives in the heart of abortion ban America. In 2018, Republican lawmakers in Mississippi enacted a ban on most abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy. The law was blocked by a federal judge who ruled it violated the abortion protections guaranteed by Roe v. Wade. The Supreme Court disagreed. In its June 2022 decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, the court overturned the constitutional right to abortion that had existed for nearly half a century. Within weeks, Mississippi and every state that borders it banned abortion in almost all circumstances. Lothrop told Regina the closest abortion provider for Ashley would be in Chicago. At first, Regina thought she and Ashley could drive there, but it is a 9-hour trip, and Regina would have to take off work. She would have to pay for gas, food, and a place to stay, not to mention the cost of the abortion itself. "I don't have the funds for all this," she says. So Ashley did what girls with no other options do. She did nothing. Clarksdale's in the Mississippi Delta, a vast stretch of flat, fertile land in the northwest corner of the state, between the Mississippi and Yazoo Rivers. The people who live in the Delta are predominantly black and low income. The region is an epicenter of America's ongoing black maternal health crisis. Mississippi has the second highest maternal mortality rate in the country, with 43 deaths per 100,000 live births, and the Delta has among the worst maternal health care outcomes in the state. Black women in Mississippi are four times as likely to die from pregnancy-related complications as white women. Mississippi's abortion ban is expected to result in thousands of additional births, often to low-income, high-risk mothers. Dr. Daniel Edney, Mississippi's top health official, tells Time his department is actively preparing for roughly 4,000 additional live births this year alone. Edney says improving maternal health outcomes is the number one priority for the Mississippi Health Department, which has invested $2 million in its Healthy Moms, Healthy Babies program to provide extra support for new mothers. There is a sense of following through, and not just as a predominantly pro-life state, says Edney. We don't just care about life in utero. We care about life, period, and that includes the mother's life and the baby's life. Mississippi's abortion ban contains narrow exceptions, including for rape victims and to save the life of the mother. But Ashley's case shows these exceptions are largely theoretical. Even if a victim files a police report, there appears to be no clear process for gaining an exception. The state attorney general's office did not return Time's repeated request to clarify the process for granting exceptions. The Mississippi Board of Medical Licensure and the Mississippi State Medical Association did not reply to Time's requests for explanation. And of course, there are no abortion providers left in the state. In January, the New York Times reported, since Mississippi's abortion law went into effect, only two exceptions had been made. Even if the process for obtaining one were clear, it would not have helped Ashley. Regina did not know that Mississippi's abortion ban had an exception for rape. Even before Dobbs, it was perilous to become a mother in rural Mississippi. More than half the counties in the state can be classified as maternity care deserts, according to a 2023 report from the March of Dimes, meaning there are no birthing facilities or obstetric providers. More than 24% of women in Mississippi have no birthing hospital within a 30-minute drive, compared with the national average of roughly 10%. According to Edney, there are just 9 OBGYNs serving a region larger than the state of Delaware. Every time an OBGYN retires, Balthrop gets an influx of new patients. These patients are having to drive further to get the same care, and then they're having to wait longer, Balthrop says. Those backups can have cascading effects. Balthrop recalls one woman who had to wait 4 weeks to get an appointment. That is unacceptable because you don't know if she's high risk or not until she sees you, the doctor says. The patient didn't know she was pregnant. Now the time has elapsed so much that she cannot drive any place to terminate, even if she chose to. Early data suggests the Dobbs decision will make this problem worse. Younger doctors and medical students do not want to move to states with abortion restrictions. When Emory University researcher Ariana Traub surveyed almost 500 third and fourth year medical students in 2022, close to 80% said abortion laws influenced where they planned to apply to residency. Nearly 60% said they were unlikely to apply to any residency programs in states with abortion restrictions. Traub had assumed abortion would be most important to students studying obstetrics, but was surprised to find 3/4 of students across all medical specialties said Dobbs was affecting their residency decisions. People often forget doctors are people and patients too, Traub says, and residency is often the time when people are in their mid-30s and thinking of starting a family. Traub found medical students were not just reluctant to practice in states with abortion bans, they did not want to become pregnant there either. So Dobbs has compounded America's maternal health crisis. More women are giving birth to more babies in areas where there are already not enough doctors, while abortion bans are making it more difficult to recruit qualified providers to the regions that need them most. People always ask me, why do you choose to stay there, says Balthrop, who's worked in the Delta for more than 20 years. I feel like I have no choice at this point. The weeks went on, and Ashley entered her second trimester. She wore bigger clothes to hide her bump until she was so big, Regina took her out of school. They told everyone Ashley needed surgery for a bad ulcer. We've been keeping it quiet because people judge wrong when they don't know what's going on, Regina says. She's been trying to keep Ashley away from nosy people. For months, Ashley spent most of the day alone, finishing up sixth grade on her laptop. The family still has no plans to tell anybody about the pregnancy. It's going to be a little private matter here, Regina says. Ashley has ADHD and trouble focusing and has an individualized education program at school. She'd never talked much, but after the rape, she went from shy to almost mute. Regina thinks she may have been too traumatized to speak. At first, Regina could not even get Ashley to tell her about the rape at all. In an interview in a side bedroom, while Ashley watched TV with Peanut in another room, Regina recounted the details of her daughter's sexual assault as she understands them. It was a weekend in the fall, shortly after lunchtime, and Ashley, then 12, had been outside their home making TikToks while her uncle and sibling were inside. A man came down the street and into the front yard, grabbed Ashley and covered her mouth, Regina says. He pulled her around to the side of the house and raped her. Ashley told Regina that her assailant was an adult and that she did not know him. Nobody else witnessed the assault. Shortly after finding out Ashley was pregnant, Regina filed a complaint with the Clarksdale Police Department. The department's assistant chief of police, Vincent Ramirez, confirmed to Time that a police report had been filed in the matter, but refused to share the document because it involved a minor. Regina says another family member believed they'd identified the rapist through social media sleuthing. The family says they flagged the man they suspected to the police, but the investigation seemed to go nowhere. Ramirez declined to comment, but an investigator in the department confirmed to Time that an arrest has not yet been made. With their investigation still incomplete, police have not yet publicly said they believe Ashley's pregnancy resulted from sexual assault. Regina felt the police were not taking the case seriously. She says she was told that in order to move the investigation forward, the police needed DNA from the baby after its birth. Experts say this is not unusual. Although it's technically possible to obtain DNA from a fetus, police are often reluctant to initiate an invasive procedure on a pregnant victim. They typically test DNA only on fetal remains or after a baby's born. But almost 3 days after Peanut's birth, the police still had not picked up the DNA sample. It was only after inquiries from Time that officers finally collected it. Asked at the Clarksdale police station why it had taken so long for crucial evidence to be obtained, Ramirez shrugged. "It's a pretty high priority as a juvenile," he says, "but sometimes they slip a little bit because we've got a lot going on, but then they come back to it." Ashley does not say much when asked how it felt to learn she was pregnant. Her mouth twists, and she looks away. "Not good," she says after a long pause. "Not happy." Regina's own feelings about abortion became more complicated as the pregnancy progressed. She got pregnant with her first daughter at 17 and was a mother at 18. "I was a teen," says Regina, now 33, "but I wasn't as young as her." Regina had considered abortion during one of her own pregnancies, but her grandmother admonished her, "Your mama didn't abort you." Now, Regina felt caught between her family's general disapproval of abortion and the realization that her 13-year-old daughter was pregnant as a result of a rape. "I wish she had just told me when it happened. We could have gotten Plan B or something," Regina says, referring to the emergency contraceptive often known as the morning after pill. "That would have been that." Balthrop often sees this kind of ambivalence. Clarksdale's in the heart of the Bible Belt. Many of her patients are black women from religious families. "Even if they want to terminate their pregnancies," Balthrop says, "many of them ultimately decide not to go through with it." Since the Dobbs decision, however, Balthrop has seen an increase in incomplete abortions, which is when the pregnancy's been terminated but the uterus has not been fully emptied. Medication abortions, abortions managed with pills, which are increasingly available online, are overwhelmingly safe, but occasionally can have minor complications when the pills are not taken exactly as directed. They are having complications after. Not serious, but they'll come in with significant bleeding. "And then we still have to finish the process," Balthrop says, explaining that treatment can involve evacuating dead fetal tissue. According to Balthrop, Ashley did not have complications during her pregnancy, but she did not start speaking more till she felt the baby move around her sixth month. "That's when it hit home," Balthrop says. "She'd complain about little aches and pains that she'd never had before. That's when her mom would come in and say, 'She asked me this question,' and the three of us would sit and talk about it." "How did Ashley feel in anticipation of becoming a mother?" "Nervous," is all she will say. "Toward the end of the pregnancy, she was terrified of going into labor," Balthrop recalls. "Most of her questions were about pushing, delivery, and how painful it would be." "She was focused on the delivery process itself," Balthrop says, "not, what am I going to do when I take this baby home?" The Clarksdale Woman's Clinic, where Balthrop practices, is across the street from the emergency room at Northwest Regional Medical Center, where Ashley first learned she was pregnant. The clinic is large and welcoming, with comfortable chairs and paintings of flowers on the walls. The staff is kind and efficient. The space is clean. And it helps that the three OBGYNs on staff are black, since most of the patients are black women. The clinic's strong reputation attracts patients from an hour away in all directions. It is a lifeline in a vast region with few other maternity health options. Even for healthy patients, it can be dangerous to be pregnant in such a rural area. "We have patients who walk to our clinic. They don't have transportation," says Casey Schaun, an administrative assistant at Clarksdale Woman's. "Some can get Medicaid transportation, but it is notoriously unreliable. The roads leading to the clinic do not have good sidewalks, and temperatures in the Delta regularly reach 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the summer. Sean says the clinic gets patients who are 6 months pregnant by the time they have their first prenatal appointment. We've had patients who go to the hospital and they've already delivered, Sean says. Balthrop recalls one woman who went into labor about 7 weeks early and had to drive 45 minutes to get to the hospital. She was too late. By the time she got here, the baby had passed already, Balthrop says. I'm skipping to the last two paragraphs now to abridge this lengthy article. For Regina, the arrival of her first grandchild has not eased the pain of watching what her daughter has endured. This situation hurts the most because it was an innocent child doing what children do, playing outside. And it was my child, Regina says. It still hurts, and it's always going to hurt. Ashley does not know anybody else who has a baby. She does not want her three friends at school to find out she has one now. Regina's working on an arrangement with school so Ashley can start seventh grade remotely until she's ready to go back in person. Relatives will babysit while Regina's at work. Is there anything about motherhood Ashley's excited about? She twists her mouth, shrugs, and says nothing. Is there anything Ashley wants to say to other girls? Be careful when you go outside, she says, and stay safe. There's only one moment when Ashley smiles a little, and it is when she describes the nurses she met in the doctor's office and delivery room. One of them she remembers was nice and cool. She's decided when she grows up she wants to be a nurse too, to help people, she says. For a second, she looks like any other soon-to-be seventh grader sharing her childhood dream, and then Peanut stirs in his car seat. Regina says he needs to be fed. Ashley's face goes blank again. She is a mother now. Moving to the View opener, this is the Risk Report by Ian Bremmer. Outsiders are shaking up Latin America's politics. Guatemala and Ecuador held elections August 20, two small countries, but revealing some key trends in Latin American politics. In Guatemala, the progressive anti-corruption candidate Bernardo Arevalo won the presidential runoff in a landslide against the conservative former First Lady Sandra Torres. In Ecuador, the right-wing populist businessman Daniel Noboa edged his way into an October runoff against former President Rafael Correa's chosen candidate, Luisa Gonzalez, whom he's favored to defeat. For starters, both Arevalo and Noboa are outsiders who were polling in the low single digits just weeks before overcoming establishment candidates in their respective first-round elections. This evinces a strong voter frustration with the status quo in both countries. Guatemala accelerated its slide toward authoritarianism when electoral authorities controlled by the ruling pact arbitrarily barred multiple change candidates from participating in the race. In an effort to protect the corrupt establishment's grip on power, that left voters with familiar faces, such as three-time candidate Torres and the two-time candidate Zuri Rios, the daughter of former dictator Efrain Rios Montt. But Guatemalans rejected the government's efforts to shape the field by opting for Arevalo, the one remaining candidate with a strong anti-graft message. Similarly, Ecuador's Noboa was able to benefit from voters' desire to break out of a polarized political climate defined by differing stances toward Correa. The former president, a left-wing strongman in the mold of Venezuela's Hugo Chavez, has loomed large over the political arena since leaving office in 2017 after 10 years in power. But nearly 46% of Ecuadorians now believe the country should be run by someone who's neither Correista nor anti-Correista, according to a recent survey from local pollster Comunicas Lisa. The shocking August 9 assassination of anti-Correista candidate Fernando Villavicencio led some voters to abandon Gonzalez and look for a populist alternative. Noboa emerged as a contender because he's a political newcomer, albeit a well-known one, as the son of Alvaro Noboa, a five-time presidential candidate and one of Ecuador's wealthiest men, who avoided attacking his opponents during the campaign. Both candidates also benefited from the youth vote. In Guatemala, where 70% of the population is under the age of 35 and the average age is 26, Arevalo was able to capture significant youth support, particularly in the capital city and other urban centers where his transparency message resonated. Arevalo was also much more moderate on key social issues, offering a stark contrast to Torres' anti-gay and anti-abortion platform, and bolstering his appeal to younger voters. Meanwhile, in Ecuador, more than half of the electorate's under 40 and a quarter's under 30. At just 35 years old, Noboa was the youngest candidate in the field and would be the country's youngest ever president if he wins in October. The growing weight of the youth vote and simmering voter frustration with incumbents suggest outsiders will prevail in other upcoming elections in the region, like Argentina's, where libertarian anti-establishment upstart Javier Milei is in the pole position to win the presidency later this year. Yet once in office, outsiders will face a steep uphill climb to actually govern. In Guatemala, the corrupt ruling pact, which controls all state institutions, is aggressively seeking to undermine Arevalo. Meanwhile, if Noboa wins, his National Democratic Action Party will hold just 12 of the National Assembly's 137 seats, and a challenging economic backdrop will leave him with limited resources to fulfill his promises to voters. The only certainty in Latin American politics is more uncertainty to come. From the View World, The Decay of Iran by Karim Sajjadpour, who's a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This may be abridged due to time constraints. The Islamic Republic of Iran has thus far proved too ideologically rigid to reform and too ruthless to collapse. As in the late stages of the Soviet Union, however, the foundations decay in plain sight. Outside their homeland, women of Iranian origin become world-class mathematicians and astronauts. Inside Iran, the ruling clerics debate whether women should be allowed to ride bicycles. One year ago this month, the regime's morality police detained and beat a 22-year-old woman, Mahsa Jina Amini, for allegedly showing too much hair beneath her compulsory veil. Her death in custody triggered Iran's longest anti-government protest since the 1979 revolution that transformed the country from a U.S.-allied monarchy to an anti-American Islamist theocracy. Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei managed these protests, as he always does, by crushing dissent, dividing adversaries, refusing to offer any concessions. Over 20,000 people were arrested, over 500 killed, including several who were executed. Compromising under pressure, Khamenei believes, only projects weakness and emboldens dissent. For the U.S., Iran's internal political dynamics have a direct bearing on national security. Viewed from Washington, Tehran is the world's leading state sponsor of terrorism, is actively trying to assassinate former U.S. officials to avenge the 2019 killing of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, provides Vladimir Putin lethal drones in his war against Ukraine, and has taken more U.S. citizens hostage than any other country in the world. At least five, who've collectively spent two decades as hostages in Tehran's Evin prison, could soon be returned to the U.S., and probably have been, in return for the U.S. unfreezing at least $6 billion in Iranian assets frozen in South Korea. There should be no illusions this deal will lead to a thaw in U.S.-Iran relations. Senior Iranian officials who publicly advocate hostage training as an economic policy have already announced the practice will continue. A bigger challenge for the Biden administration heading into election season is an advancing Iran nuclear program that could potentially trigger Israeli military action and skyrocketing oil prices. 5 years after the Trump administration withdrew from the 2015 Iran nuclear agreement, signed by the Obama administration, the CIA assesses Tehran has the technical capacity to build nuclear weapons and is within weeks of having the fissile material to do so. Going for a bomb, however, would be a risky move for Khamenei. Iran's nuclear sites have been thoroughly penetrated by Israel and the U.S., as evidenced by routine acts of sabotage reported at Iranian nuclear facilities and the assassination of top nuclear scientists. Khamenei's making the decision to weaponize also risks tilting the balance of power toward the Revolutionary Guards, who would likely control the nuclear codes and aspire to control the country. Successive U.S. administrations have sought to defuse Iran's nuclear program and end the U.S.-Iran Cold War by either trying to engage the Iranian regime diplomatically or subjecting it to economic pressure in hopes the regime will either capitulate or implode. None of these efforts has borne fruit. Death to America remains the Islamic Republic's enduring slogan, but another pillar of the revolution is compulsory hijab. A year after Amini's death, thousands of Iranian women defy these rules daily, despite the regime's use of Chinese facial recognition technology to punish violation of laws of hijab and chastity. The country's economy is a shambles. Its former minister of the environment ominously warned continued mismanagement of water resources could mean 50 million Iranians, 70% of the country, will have no choice but to leave the country. Climate scientists say parts of Iran, which this year reached temperatures of 152 degrees Fahrenheit, could be the first places on Earth too hot to be inhabited by humans. After two decades of failure in Iraq and Afghanistan and the disappointing outcomes of the 2011 Arab uprisings, the U.S. has little confidence it can positively impact political outcomes in the Middle East. Indeed, absent a cohesive liberal opposition, an implosion of the Islamic Republic is less likely to be followed by an Iranian version of Jeffersonian democracy than by a military government. For now, it remains a security state, commanded by an octogenarian cleric, who's held the title of supreme leader since 1989, before most Iranians were born. Everyone's just waiting, a recent visitor from Tehran told me, for the leader to die. Turning now for a minute or two to the list of Time's young luminaries. May, M.A.E. Martin, Candid Humor by Elliot Page, who's an activist, author, and Oscar and Emmy-nominated actor. One can only imagine how profound an impact Mae Martin has had across the world. If the way their work has affected me is any indication, that impact is immense. their candor in speaking about sexuality, identity, and addiction, all while making us laugh endlessly, is not just life-affirming, but also life-altering. They have the power to crack you open, to release you from shame. Whether in their gorgeously written and stunningly performed television series or their stand-up specials, they resist the urge to hold back, and it is a true joy and inspiration to witness. They step forward gracefully but unapologetically, with confidence and undeniable brilliance, to remind us what being alive is all about, being our full, authentic selves. May has certainly done that for me. Mira Murati, Engineering, What's Next in AI, by Satya Nadella, who is CEO and Executive Chairman of Microsoft. Mira Murati has had a very impressive career as a leader in the tech industry, and most recently as OpenAI's Chief Technology Officer. Through her dedication to democratizing AI, her ability to bring together diverse teams, and the fearlessness with which she tackles technical challenges, Mira has helped to scale the company from a startup to one of the most important AI companies in the world. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.